This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. Jennifer Salazar lives in Rock Springs, Wyoming. We're on a warm Saturday in October. She meets up with reporter Tennessee Watson at a park on the edge of town.
Hey, I'm Tennessee.
I'm Jennifer. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
It's been so crazy.
Oh, they're at a park, and not her house, partly because of the pandemic and because Jennifer has something to share that her husband, Andrew, isn't ready to talk about. It's still hard for her, too.
So I will tell you, and I'll apologize now, but this is the month that my daughter passed away. So if you notice, I'm not wearing makeup, and I brought Kleenex because it's going to be a little hard.
It's been 3 years since Jennifer and Andrew's daughter, Larissa, died. She just turned 16 when it happened. And it made Jennifer question whether Wyoming was a safe place to raise her two younger kids.
It freaks me out to, like, raise kids here. And even though they say Wyoming is a good place to raise kids, I tell my husband, like, I don't know, like, is there a risk that we take raising them here that they make a wrong step and get into the system and the same thing happens? Like, it freaks me out like it does.
The system Jennifer is talking about is the juvenile justice system. Jennifer's daughter, Larissa, was in eighth grade when she got into a fight on the school bus. And that snowballed into 16 months in a state juvenile facility. The justice system was responding to a kid with a lot more going on in her life than just one fight on the bus. But rather than rehabilitate, Jennifer says that system made things worse.
These kids need help, and all they're doing is putting them in the system and saying, here, you're going to be away from your family for 9 months to a year. And then, you know, then after that, you're going to be on probation again. Like, how effective is that?
Research says it's not. That's why many states are moving away from punishing kids, especially for low-level or nonviolent offenses. It turns out that doing things like locking kids up doesn't change their behavior. So there's a push to create programs that support troubled kids and keep them in the community. But these reforms aren't a top priority everywhere. A handful of states continue to lock up kids at twice the national average, and Wyoming tops the list. Jennifer believes that has a lot to do with why Larissa is no longer alive today. Tennessee Watson pieced together Larissa's experience with the juvenile justice system and has this story about why Wyoming is so tough on kids.
Larissa Salazar was born and raised in Rock Springs, a mining town in southwestern Wyoming. Pink and red rock buttes dot the horizon, and wild horses roam the sage-covered desert right outside of town. About 23,000 people live here. It's the biggest town for over 100 miles. Larissa's early childhood here wasn't easy. When she was little, her biological mom, who's not Jennifer, struggled with drug addiction and was in and out of jail. Her parents split up when she was around 5 years old, and her mom pretty much disappeared from Larissa's life. When her dad met Jennifer and they got married, Larissa struggled to adjust. But despite those challenges, Jennifer says Larissa was a kid with a big heart.
She was one of those kids that were, like, non-judgmental. If you were gay or straight, or if you were fat or skinny, or if you, you know, didn't have the clothes that other kids had or shoes or whatever, she would want to still be your friend. And she would want to, like, give her stuff to you and just always wanting to, like, help people.
Jennifer found this old video of Larissa playing with her younger brother.
What?
Yes.
She has long brown hair and a nose ring. She's sitting on the floor while her brother runs circles around her.
I love you.
Larissa loved her family, but she had a rebellious side too. That's a common way kids respond to trauma, and it got Larissa into trouble. One night, she said she was going to a friend's house for a sleepover, but instead she was hanging out with a group of kids behind the local elementary school. When her dad found her, Larissa took off running. He was in flip-flops and couldn't catch her, and it was getting late, so they called the cops for help. Officers brought Larissa home and gave her a curfew ticket, which meant she had to appear in municipal court. This is one of the ways Wyoming is different from other parts of the country. In most states, a juvenile court would handle this. But in Wyoming, most of the time, kids end up in adult courts. Jennifer didn't think it was fair for Larissa to have a curfew violation on her record or to pay a fine when they'd called the cops for help.
I went to court with her and they said, well, we're going to have you guys pay the fines. And I was like, no, she needs to like do community service or something.
Jennifer says the judge took her advice and put Larissa in a diversion program. She had to agree to do some community service and to stay out of trouble. And the curfew ticket would disappear.
And it did seem to work. Like, she kind of grew up a little bit. She was, you know, respectable in the house. Like, she was trying, you know. And then she got sexually assaulted.
You heard that right. Just as things were starting to turn around, Larissa was sexually assaulted. It was the day after Christmas, and Larissa was sleeping over at a girlfriend's house. Late at night, the girl's 19-year-old brother came home, and Jennifer says Larissa was the only one still up.
And the 19-year-old boy wound up dragging her inside of a room and sexually assaulting her.
Larissa decided to speak up about the assault, and that turned her closest friends into enemies. This was especially traumatic because until she'd met them, Larissa struggled to feel accepted at school. She was often bullied by other kids, bullied for being chubby when she was little, bullied for her free spirit. The 19-year-old was prosecuted and pled guilty to sexual abuse of a minor. And after that, Jennifer says his younger sister started harassing Larissa at school, slut-shaming her and telling her she wanted it, and getting other kids to badmouth Larissa too. Jennifer says Larissa put up with the bullying for months, but with just a few weeks of school left, she decided to strike back.
She was on the bus, and she called me crying. And she said, they won't stop, Mom. They won't stop telling everybody on the bus what happened. And it's so hard for me to keep hearing what happened. And I said, just get off the bus and just come home. And if we have to do something different next year, we will, you know? And she was like, I'm going to physically assault one of them because I'm tired. They were sitting right in back of her. And they were saying, like, I'm going to hit you. Like, I'm going to do this to you. They were pulling her hair. And she had had enough. And when the bus stopped, she got up and she punched one of them in their mouth.
The case was filed in juvenile court, and Larissa was charged with battery, which carries a maximum sentence of 6 months. But the judge put her on probation, and Jennifer says, at first, that seemed like a good thing.
But then when she was on probation, they treated her like, okay, you're a criminal, you're on probation. Like, there's not, you know, this, there's no other help. You know what I'm saying? You're just on probation. You're going to follow the rules. You're going to follow the rules of your house. You're going to follow the rules at school. And if you don't, you're going to be sent away, you know?
And so when you saw it, when you were watching this happen and it wasn't fair, did you have any tools as a parent to say?
I mean, we addressed it with them a couple times, but they were just like, well, she's on probation and she has rules she has to follow.
Jennifer says Larissa was still reeling from the sexual assault, but that trauma got kind of lost in the shuffle. Juvenile probation officers monitor who kids are hanging out with, what they're doing on social media, whether they're behaving at home, as well as their grades and attendance at school. Bad friends and bad grades aren't a crime, but on probation, it can get kids sent away. This isn't unique to Wyoming, but it happens here more.
And then once they're in probation, that's the real slippery slope.
Kathy Sizemore has been a teacher in Rock Springs since the 1980s. She didn't have Larissa as a student, but she's taught a lot of kids who've been on probation.
I explained to the kids, it's like you're now on the radar, and every little thing you do is going to be scrutinized. And whereas other kids can get away with it, you won't be able to. And if you do enough naughty things or continue those behaviors that got you there in the first place, eventually your probation might be revoked and they'll take you back to court. And so the judge can then say, well, this isn't working. Let's send you to a placement.
And the threat of being incarcerated for slipping up on probation is real, according to data from the U.S. Department of Justice. Wyoming locks up kids for probation violations at a rate well above the national average, higher than neighboring states and other states with small populations. Larissa resented the power probation had over her life. Even though she wasn't charged with a drug-related offense, she was required to do routine urine analysis, or UAs, at the juvenile probation office. Jennifer says for a 13-year-old kid who'd just been sexually assaulted, that was just too much.
Having to, like, do UAs in front of somebody, she already struggled with her body and feeling, like, self-conscious. And so, like, every time she would have to go do a UA and probation standing in there, she would come out and she would cry to me and tell me how demeaning it was and that she didn't want to, like, be, like, exposed in front of somebody.
And it might sound simple. Don't do drugs and pass the UA. Behave on probation and you won't be sent away. But for Larissa, behaving was hard because of the intense emotion she felt. That's not unusual, according to research from the Justice Department, which says up to 70% of juvenile offenders have a diagnosable mental health condition, often caused by trauma. And because teen brains aren't fully developed, they often make irrational decisions anyway. In Larissa's case, after asking a friend for alcohol on Facebook, she was scared her probation agent would see and send her away. She panicked and took a bunch of pills.
I was on my way to go to Walmart, and she comes running out to the driveway, and I said, oh, you're going to go? So I opened the car door thinking she was just going to jump in and go, and she said, no, Mom, I took some pills. And I took a whole bunch of them, and I think I'm going to die from it. And I instantly panicked, and I rushed her to the ER.
While Larissa was treated with charcoal to absorb the pills, Jennifer sat with her in the hospital.
She looks at me and she says, does people even care that people get assaulted and that their lives are never the same? And I said, I care. And she said, yeah, but does anybody else? And I said, I think they do. And she said, how do they care when I'm put on probation and I'm treated like a criminal? Just said, I hate this. I hate probation. And I hate that I can't just be a normal kid.
After the suicide attempt, a judge sent Larissa to a psych hospital on the opposite side of the state for a few weeks, then directly to the girls' school, a state juvenile facility. Jennifer says she wanted to give Larissa a ride from the hospital to the girls' school to ease the transition, but that wasn't allowed.
And I asked if she could come home. I said, well, can we visit her? Like, you know, what? And she said, no, we're going to transport her directly from WBI.
Chris Jones, who runs the Wyoming Girls' School, says most of the girls sent to the facility have been through some trauma. That's why judges send girls there.
Judges know that when the kids get here, they are going to get therapy and good schooling, and they're going to be safe. And I think that plays into it.
The place feels like a boarding school with a big quad surrounded by dorms with views of the mountains in the distance. But the girls can't leave, so even though it doesn't look like incarceration, it is. Chris says the goal is to help girls, not punish them. It's a lesson she learned years ago when a girl wouldn't take a babysitting class.
And this young woman refused to go. She threw a fit. So she got a consequence. We addressed the behavior. She got a consequence. And her therapist came to me on Monday and said, you know, she was severely molested by a babysitter. And it was just like, you know, the scales fall off. We still have to address behavior. But if you understand what's behind the behavior, what's driving the behavior, rather than just addressing the behavior, then you have the hope of changing it permanently.
Chris says being sent away from your community and family is dramatic enough. Her goal is not to add to that. Jennifer says the separation was hard on Larissa, but the Salazars made the 5-hour trek, sometimes across icy roads, to visit as often as they could. Jennifer saw that Larissa had access to activities that were hard to come by at home in Rock Springs. Therapy there helped her rebuild trust with her family. Horseback riding and yoga made her feel good, and she was into the small classes and individualized learning. But Chris Jones says it's when girls go home that things fall apart.
If they're successful here, that's great. But the key is making that transfer into the home community.
And not every community is on board with that trauma-informed approach or makes it as easy for kids to stay engaged in positive activities. Jennifer has the discharge papers from Larissa's trip to the girls' school, which show she was both scared and excited about going back to Rock Springs.
Says that although she has skills to avoid resorting to old and negative learned behaviors, she knows that there will be many pressures and it will be up to her to think of consequences before she acts.
She matured from her 8 months at the girls' school, but Larissa was put right back on probation when she got home.
Because every time they release them,
then they're on probation.
They're on probation again.
And within 4 months, she was back at the girls' school for violating her probation. Jennifer says Larissa got caught sneaking out of the house, drinking, and hanging out with someone on her no-contact list.
It just, I don't know, it seems very harsh to me. But me and my husband just obeyed because you're under a court order and that's what you do.
The judge calling the shots on Larissa's case was Nina James. In 2019, she stepped down after running the juvenile court in Sweetwater County for close to 20 years. She doesn't remember the specifics of Larissa's case, but was willing to talk more generally about her approach to juvenile justice.
I think the reason I was so passionate about kids is because I have kids of my own. I sat there as a mother as much as a judge.
She says she wanted what was best for kids, and that meant holding them to high standards, something she was worried wasn't happening at home or in school.
Kids are allowed to retake tests if they do bad. And I'm always thinking, what is that about? We're preparing kids for the workforce. They can't not do their work on time. This is awful.
When kids appeared in her court, the buck stopped there. Her approach was to hold them accountable and hopefully get them back on track.
And so I saw an out-of-home placement in some cases as a very, very beneficial thing to, one, keep the kids safe, keep them alive so you can help them, and then, two, you know, get them that help, the counseling and the resources that we didn't have locally.
This is something I heard a lot in my reporting, that because Wyoming is so huge and many counties have such small populations, they can't support local programs to help kids who've gotten in trouble. But Judge James says sending kids away is not just about resources. She believes it also teaches them an important lesson.
And hope that while they were out of their home, they kind of grew up a little bit. Sometimes you have to have things taken away from you before you understand how much you really like them, you know?
James says she's heard positive feedback.
I have gotten so many letters from so many kids who have told me that if I hadn't intervened in their lives, they wouldn't be where they are.
I talked to people who said that too, but Jennifer has some different feedback for Judge James. She says during that second stint at the girls' school, Larissa lost hope that she'd ever get out of the system. Being sent back changed Larissa, and not for the better.
She learned things in there that I don't think she would ever learned at home. You know, self-mutilation, how to strangle yourself until you can't breathe anymore and you pass out and then you wake up. Like, I don't know, like how, we didn't do that at home.
Jennifer told me she was worried about Larissa's safety. Her daughter wasn't the same person anymore.
The psychological harm kids like Larissa experience when they're uprooted from their families, schools, and communities is why many states are working to reduce juvenile incarceration. But Wyoming is resisting.
If there's no one holding them accountable, then what motivation do they have to change their practice?
When we come back, the reasons Wyoming isn't changing course when it comes to juvenile justice. You're listening to Reveal.
support for Reveal comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is an all-in-one management software with apps for every business need. Odoo has apps for CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, manufacturing, and everything in between. And they're all in one easy-to-use software. And the best part about Odoo? All Odoo apps are integrated, helping you get things done faster and more efficiently. So when you think about business, think Odoo. To learn more, visit odoo.com/reveal. That's odoo.com/reveal.
This podcast is supported by Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Americans United defends your freedom to live as yourself and believe as you choose, so long as you don't harm others. Core freedoms like abortion rights, marriage equality, public education, and even democracy itself rest upon the wall of separation between church and state. A network of anti-democratic groups are attacking these freedoms, seeking to force us all to live by their narrow beliefs. Americans United is fighting back. Freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more about AU's work at au.org/MJ.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. We're looking at Wyoming's high juvenile incarceration rate and why the state has done little to address the problem. Tennessee Watson takes a look at what's standing in the way and what that means for kids like Larissa Salazar.
When Larissa came home from her second trip to the girls' school, the transition was rough.
She was very clammed up and wouldn't share a lot of stuff.
Larissa had been gone for 16 months, even though her initial charge for battery carries a maximum 6-month sentence. And after all that time, she barely knew her two younger siblings, who were just 2 and 4.
And they almost felt like they were strangers, you know?
Jennifer says Larissa felt disconnected at school, too.
She felt behind from, the girls' school to, regular high school. She didn't have a group of friends anymore. She'd now been away 2 years almost.
She had a lot to adjust to and was still dealing with the pressure of being back on juvenile probation. The office where kids go to meet with their probation agent and to do urine analysis is in the basement of a building in downtown Rock Springs. The waiting area has bowls of candy and condoms. There are motivational posters on the wall. And I'm here to meet with Karen Kelly.
I am the director of Sweetwater County Juvenile Probation.
She's worked in the program for over 20 years.
What do you see in your work that makes you feel like, yeah, this is making a difference?
We really focus on kind of those little wins. The kid who has failed math for a year passed their math test on Friday. That's a win.
The ultimate goal is for kids to complete probation, but Karen says that's definitely challenging.
One student or juvenile who doesn't have substance abuse issues, passing those drug tests is a very easy part of their probation. Another kid who has academic problems, the requirement of going to school every day and being on time to your classes and making progress and doing the best you can in school, that sometimes becomes the hard part. But I think it is hard. I think it's hard once you get in the system to work yourself back out. That is difficult.
But she says not every kid who violates probation is immediately sent away. They try first to refer them to services like tutoring and counseling to see if that helps.
And so we can make those referrals, we can help with those interventions, but it really is up to that juvenile and that family to take advantage of that, and some do and some don't.
Karen says there's a balance between helping kids and holding them to what the prosecutor and judge ordered.
We are here trying to help them comply with that court order. We don't have a lot of wiggle room and leeway any more than the kid does.
Jennifer says beyond counseling, there wasn't much else to help Larissa stay on track. The girls' school offered structured, positive activities, But Karen says probation doesn't provide that.
It's a lot of compliance checks and referring and identifying what other community programs are there, but we don't provide a lot of that programming.
She'd like to offer more, but she says the county doesn't have the money. So how many kids make it through probation, and how many are sent away? Karen can't answer that, which she immediately realizes is a problem.
You asked some very basic questions that I don't have answers to, and I should have answers to.
That's because in Wyoming, each county decides what to do when kids get in trouble, and they all do it differently. Some counties believe incarceration is necessary, others don't. Some send kids to adult courts, while others send them to juvenile courts, or a mixture of both. On top of that, Wyoming doesn't require counties to follow what happens to kids once they're in the system. So there's no way to track whether kids are being rehabilitated or not.
If you're not required to collect data to show that it's not working, it's much easier to stick to it.
That's John Toole from the Robert F. Kennedy National Resource Center for Juvenile Justice. He spent the last 25 years helping communities rethink how they deal with kids who get in trouble. But he hasn't worked in Wyoming. He says that's because juvenile justice just hasn't been a priority for the state.
I mean, I don't mean to laugh at a tragedy, but I think Wyoming may have the corner on the market.
For many years, Wyoming was the only state not to participate in the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act. The 1974 legislation provides federal funds to states that agree to do things like decrease the use of incarceration for low-level offenses and to monitor racial and ethnic disparities. From 1996 to 2001, John worked for the Department of Justice administering the program. But he says Wyoming declined the federal dollars and continued to do things its own way.
They have a long history of that absence of partnership and therefore absence of accountability to the federal government.
John says that partnership ended up helping kids in many states, and Wyoming missed out. The interesting thing is John used to believe more in punishment than rehabilitation.
In my younger days, I guarantee you that I worked against what the research would say works now.
Before working at the DOJ, he worked as a juvenile probation agent in Virginia for close to 20 years.
My approach was, if I hold them accountable for the conditions that were imposed by the court, then they'll have some structure, some discipline, and some ability to overcome adversity. And that's what my job was.
But then John says he realized he was just pushing kids deeper into the system and not helping them overcome the trauma and instability causing their delinquent behavior. He says programs that give kids positive interactions and experiences and focus on helping them feel safe and supported make the biggest difference. But John learned that lesson the hard way.
I think I had a role in the ultimate demise of three kids that I worked with, and it was their own self-demise by suicide.
And that heartbreaking realization didn't come right away.
To argue that I had an epiphany with their passing, that I needed to look at a different approach, that would be too Hollywood. I didn't feel that way at the time.
He says he was able to overlook those deaths because there was no oversight. He was holding kids accountable for their actions, but no one was holding him accountable. He says that's what's happening in Wyoming.
I mean, they get to tell an anecdotal story that might signify success, but if they don't have results or data, they're not forced to confront the fact that what they're doing is unsuccessful or works against what the research says. And who pays? Well, the kids pay.
Kids like Larissa. And that's what Jennifer didn't want to talk about in front of her husband, Andrew, when she arranged to meet with me at the park. Jennifer says when Larissa came back from her second trip to the girls' school and was put on probation, she hit an all-time low.
It's almost like she was like going into a depression, and I reached out to probation. And her probation officer wasn't there, but I talked to the supervisor and I said, look, I don't know how to help her. I said, she's not doing, like, she's not bad in the home. Like, she was very respectable. Like, she was doing what she needs to do. I said, but I see there's something going on with her emotionally.
Jennifer says she wanted probation to ease off to let Larissa adjust to school. She wanted probation to call and tell Larissa she was doing a good job.
And She says, well, your probation officer's not in right now. I can leave a message. We can try to call her, maybe schedule a meeting. And I said, well, I kind of need this to happen, like, ASAP. The feeling is not right to me. I said, I mean, we need to, like, do something for her, you know? And she says, okay, well, we can figure it out. I'll give you a call back.
Jennifer says she made that call on Tuesday. 2 days later, Andrew found Larissa dead in her room. She'd taken her own life.
Even to the last week of her life, you know, I called and I tried to get help for her.
Jennifer says Larissa was failed. Is it fair to lay Larissa's death entirely at the feet of Wyoming's juvenile justice system? Probably not. Sadly, there were too many traumatic things in Larissa's life to isolate just one cause of her suicide. She'd had her ups and downs mentally from the time she was a little kid, but from Jennifer's perspective, the juvenile justice system made things worse.
Would she have benefited more from not being institutionalized, but having more interaction, like here locally, to where she could get help that she needed and, you know, like still be here with us?
I went to meet with the two juvenile probation agents who worked Larissa's case, Diana Melton and Crystal Britt.
Hey.
Hi, come on in. We're all going here because
I wanted to know if Larissa's suicide made them rethink their work.
Not make me rethink anything, but it is just you feel for that family. You never forget any of that.
Crystal says while she doesn't 100% agree with everything about the juvenile justice system, she thinks they do more good than harm.
I think there is a lot of pressure. But life has a lot of pressure, and you have to learn that. Adults don't always handle the pressure all that well either. She was a good kid, and it was terrible what happened. But a lot of parents say, well, you're putting a lot of stress on my kid. You're putting a lot of stress on my kid, my family. I don't really know how else to say it, and I don't want to sound rude, but we didn't put you here.
And once kids end up on probation, there are limited options Diana and Crystal can offer them, no matter how much they may want to help. Judge Gary Hartman says Wyoming's use of probation and incarceration has more to do with the system's own momentum than what's actually good for kids.
There has been a tradition to say, you're going to be in court, you're going to have to answer to this. And I think that's a hard thing to break. It's difficult to turn the ship.
When Hartman was a juvenile court judge, he tried to steer his district in a new direction. He looped in social workers and educators who knew the kids who ended up in his courtroom. And as a team, they made decisions about what would help the most. That approach became state law, and now all juvenile court judges have to take recommendations from a community team. But people who serve on those teams say they end up sending kids away to places like the girls' school because resources aren't available locally. Right now, Hartman says there's no incentive to change that.
The state is the one that actually pays the bill when these kids go into placement.
In other words, it's cheaper for counties to send troubled kids away because it's the state that covers the cost.
So instead of working in the community to try and solve the problem, I think prosecutors and judges, too, will send the kid out to say, out of sight, out of mind, we're not going to worry about them for 6 or 8 months. We'll worry about them when they come back.
And for counties that want to build programs to keep kids out of the justice system and in their own communities, they mostly pay for that on their own because the state sets aside very little money for that. But even if the state gave money to counties for local programs,
that doesn't mean that it's going to solve the problem of keeping the kids in the community.
That's because the state provides very little oversight. Right now, counties aren't forced to measure whether they're actually helping kids. I wanted to find out if the state was willing to put that kind of pressure on counties. So I called up Governor Mark Gordon.
Hey, it's Tennessee calling.
He's a Republican who's been in office for 2 years.
What role should the state play in reducing juvenile incarceration rates?
Well, Tennessee, you know, obviously it's an evolving issue. And so I think that conversation at a statewide level is very valuable. But the issue in Wyoming for a long time has been dealt with on a local level, and we are a local control state. And that's always been, you know, sort of the tradition there.
But that tradition has costs. Costs for young people who end up incarcerated at higher rates, costs for their long-term well-being, because the state's model doesn't require counties to prove their approach is working. And it's costing the state a lot of money. I looked at what Wyoming has spent on juvenile justice for the last 10 years. And Sweetwater County, where Larissa was from, cost the state more than any other county. And it's mostly for sending kids to juvenile facilities. Sweetwater spends more than even the most populated county, home to the state capital, Cheyenne. This is at a time when Wyoming needs to save money. The state gets most of its revenue from taxes on coal, oil, and gas. But with those industries in decline, the state budget has been shrinking, and that's only gotten worse with the pandemic.
Given the financial situation we're in, why not put some pressure on the counties to try and figure out a more affordable, more effective way to deal with troubled kids?
You know, in terms of the term pressure, my sense is it's much better as a conversation, because then we're all going to arrive at a much better solution. And I think the points you're making about community-based approaches, those are always better. But we have had a massive change in our revenue picture, huge reductions, and I think everybody's just trying to get through to the next day before we have a chance to really sit down and say, okay, now let's reallocate our resources.
State revenue has gone down so much that Governor Gordon is calling for across-the-board budget cuts. That includes eliminating the small amount the state does give for community-based programs, even though the research says they're more effective than incarceration. In the meantime, prosecutors and judges are not being asked to send fewer kids away.
If Wyoming wanted to figure out how to help kids who get in trouble and at the same time save money, it wouldn't have to look far to get ideas. Next up, we go to South Dakota. That state had high juvenile incarceration rates like Wyoming, but in the last 5 years, decided to try something different. You're listening to Reveal. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. When we met Jennifer Salazar at the park, she was thinking about leaving Wyoming. She didn't want to take a chance on her younger children getting caught in its juvenile justice system, like her daughter Larissa did. If Jennifer wanted to find a state that's taking a different approach to kids who run into trouble, she could go to South Dakota. It's just one state over to the east, and for many years was similar to Wyoming with high juvenile incarceration rates. But then South Dakota caught on to what a lot of other states had already figured out. Kids who are incarcerated are more likely to get in trouble again, whereas kids who receive support close to home are not. So South Dakota decided to change direction. Tennessee Watson picks up the story in a rural community that's trying this new approach to juvenile justice.
Mitchell, South Dakota's big claim to fame is the Corn Palace. The building's exterior is decorated with mosaics made from different colored corn kernels. I catch a glimpse of it on my way to meet Katie Bushbach at the local rec center. She's waiting outside for me with a big smile on her face.
Let's go ahead and we'll take you guys inside.
Katie works for Davison County, where Mitchell is located. And it's her job to keep kids out of lockup and in the community. That includes coordinating a diversion program to keep them out of the courts. Today, Katie is trying something new because she noticed a lot of the kids in her program weren't involved in after-school activities.
Do you know why that's happening?
I would say a lot of it is mom and dad are at work. Maybe their second job and they can't take them to, you know, those appointments or to practice and things like that. So it makes it hard for some of those kids to be able to do that.
But that unsupervised time after school is when kids get in trouble. So she started up a program on Wednesday evenings to give them a little extra support. And she asked the rec center to host it because every kid can get a ride here on a school bus. Katie's expecting three girls to show up today. And as they arrive, volunteer Ashley Anson is pulling out art supplies. But Ashley's not an art teacher. She's a lawyer who takes court-appointed cases to represent low-income families. And she felt frustrated by the juvenile justice system.
I felt sort of helpless in the courtroom. Like, I can give a sentencing argument any day, but really I don't feel like it's very helpful. You're kind of stuck with whatever parameters are available.
And for a long time, probation or incarceration felt like the only options for kids who got in trouble. Ashley didn't want kids sent away, but she wasn't sure they'd get what they needed sticking around town. She says Katie's work has given her and the kids a local option.
It helped me immensely in my job as a defense attorney.
Tonight, Ashley is facilitating a workshop on smash booking. It's like a feistier and less organized version of scrapbooking.
Okay, so we're gonna start out focusing on the negative emotions, but it'll end on a happy positive note, I promise.
She asked the girls in the group to share negative thoughts they have about themselves that might get them in trouble. An eighth grader who goes by the name Marie jumps in.
So you, like, don't want to drink or you don't want to, like, smoke with them and then they just, like, bash you for it? Like,
Marie is hard to hear through her mask. She's talking about feeling pressure from friends to drink and smoke. And Ashley helps Marie think through how that leads to negative feelings about herself.
So the negative idea you have about what they think of you if you say no would be you aren't friendable, you can't fit in.
Yeah, fit in.
I'm uncool. That's perfect.
Ashley asked the girls to write some of those negative beliefs on a blank sheet of paper.
Gel pens up here, color pencils, markers, Sharpies, whatever you want to use.
And the girls spend some time modge-podging over the negativity with layers of positive words and images they've cut from magazines. Marie says tonight was helpful. She hadn't realized how the pressure from friends to do drugs impacted her self-esteem.
I don't like saying no. It's just something that I struggle with. And since I've been friends with them for so long, it's just hard to drop friends that you're, like, close with. It's just...
How come you're here and they're not?
I got caught with the most things, and they didn't. So.
Okay.
It's fine. I want to get better. I want to stop, so it's probably for the best anyway.
Even with realizations like that, Katie says behavior doesn't change right away.
It doesn't matter if it's a kid or an adult. I mean, we all make poor choices at some point, and it's going to take repetition to learn that. So instead of saying, you know, okay, we tried a diversion one time with you and you should have learned, now you're going to have to face the consequences. We're teaching them how to make a better decision the next time.
This approach isn't just about being nice. It's based on the well-researched fact that kids' brains are different from adults. The frontal lobe that controls how we respond to our emotions isn't fully developed until we're in our 20s. In other words, Katie says,
kids are just hardwired to do stupid stuff.
And no amount of punishment is going to change that. But figuring out the stresses kids are feeling and giving them steady, positive reinforcement does help them make better choices. Katie's job is to coordinate that support. But not so long ago, Katie's job didn't exist. So what changed? Well, for almost two decades, South Dakota had the highest juvenile incarceration rates in the country, right along with Wyoming. In South Dakota, 70% of the kids incarcerated there were locked up for low-level offenses or violating probation. This was costing the state a ton of money, up to $144,000 per kid a year. And it didn't work. Nearly half the young people released from state facilities were locked up again within 3 years. Those numbers caught the attention of Republican Governor Dennis Dugard. He also saw that states that moved towards community-based alternatives had lower recidivism rates and were saving money. He wanted that for South Dakota, but he had to convince lawmakers who thought kids who broke rules should be punished and sent away. The argument that it would save money helped win them over. In 2015, Dugard signed comprehensive juvenile justice reforms into law. And by the time he gave his State of the State address in 2017, South Dakota was starting to see results.
Now, the statutory purpose of our juvenile justice system is rehabilitation. And locking up youth has been shown to make them more likely to commit crimes as adults. The reforms invested $6.1 million in expanded community-based treatment.
Within 5 years of those reforms, the total number of incarcerated youth in South Dakota declined by half. So did the juvenile corrections budget, from close to $30 million down to $15. South Dakota funnels a portion of that savings back to communities that run successful diversion programs. In Wyoming, incentives like that don't exist. Katie's program in Davison County has seen success in part because of how it collaborates with schools. Shane Thill welcomes me into a conference room. He's the director of Mitchell's alternative high school, Second Chance Academy. He says before South Dakota's juvenile justice reform, he watched kids bounce in and out of facilities.
And they'd be gone for 6 months, a year, whatever. And what we had noticed is when they would come back, they were okay for about a week, but then after that, basically all hell broke loose and boom, they're gone again. So the frustration was, how are you going to help these individuals become stronger community members if they're not within the community and if they don't really learn how to be a positive citizen within the community?
Shane says schools now play an important role in keeping kids local because staff spend a lot of time with them. When they see bad behavior or mental health issues, they can intervene before things spiral out of control.
This is a very frustrating population to deal with, but you have to set aside your own frustration and understand that this kid just watched his mother get beat to a pulp by a boyfriend. And now you want him to do 40 math problems? It's like, it's not gonna happen because he is not functionally situated emotionally to handle that right now.
Shane says the key to supporting kids who are struggling is making sure they show up at school. That's where Katie Bushbach comes in. In addition to coordinating the county's diversion program, she'll go find kids who are absent.
I love going to get kids to take them to school. It's my favorite thing in the world, and I'm not being sarcastic. I love going and picking kids up in the morning and helping them get to school. I'm just kind of making it a bright spot in the day. Being silly, goofy, playing some music on the way to school.
This hasn't always been Katie's MO. Once upon a time, she was a juvenile probation agent playing hardball with kids who cut class. But get this, she lost that job because of South Dakota's juvenile justice reform.
And so the reform happened and your job was cut, and were you like, oh, this will be great for kids? Or were you like, what the hell?
I was not excited. I can be 100% honest about that. I was thinking, this is going to be terrible. We're going to see like an uprise in crime. The kids are, you know, going to be out of control. Nobody's going to be held accountable. But that's not the case whatsoever. It's the complete opposite. You know, the kids are getting a chance to make a dumb decision and be a kid, but not having to be a criminal because they've made that bad decision.
How did you make that transition, like from the probation mentality to where you are now? What was it that helped you?
It was honestly seeing the numbers and how the diversion was working. If I was not in charge of seeing those numbers and the statistics of the success in the program, I think it would have been really hard for me to actually wrap my brain around that it does work.
Katie has that data because South Dakota requires that counties track what happens to kids in the justice system. The numbers show before the reforms, when more kids were being sent away, about 50% of them would get in trouble again. Katie says for kids in her program, it's about 8%. And the data shows what still needs improving, like how there are disproportionately more young people of color entering the system. Katie says she wants to bring that number down in Davison County. And for each kid who completes Katie's diversion program, the state pays the county $220.
There's a reward for it in two different aspects. There's a financial reward, but there's also the reward that this kid isn't going to be coming back into the system, and we're not essentially plugging this kid in and creating a criminal.
Not creating a criminal. That's, after all, what the juvenile justice system is supposed to do. But after looking at this issue for the past year, it's striking how different juvenile justice can look from one state to another. Wyoming puts its money towards sending kids away to incarceration. South Dakota funnels money to communities to give kids the support they need close to home. I took what I learned back to Jennifer Salazar, whose daughter Larissa took her own life after years in Wyoming's juvenile justice system. Here's what she had to say.
I think it's sad that us here in Wyoming, like, I mean, we live in a beautiful state. There's great people here. Like, why haven't we implemented something like that so that that way our children can be better in their future?
Wyoming might have the highest rate of juvenile incarceration, but West Virginia, Alaska, Nebraska, and Oregon also lock up kids at nearly twice the national average. It's up to those states to decide whether that's a problem they want to fix. The federal government doesn't have the authority to set juvenile justice policy or to make states follow what the research says is good for kids. Our show this week was produced by Tennessee Watson, an Abrams Neiman Fellow for Local Investigative Reporting. She had help this week from Ada Uzenlar. Taki Telenidis edited the show. Thanks to Wyoming Public Media and South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Victoria Baranetsky is our general counsel. Our production manager is Amy Mustafa. Original score and sound designed by the dynamic duo, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. That helped this week from Brett Simpson and Amita Ganatra. Our digital producer is Sarah Merck. Our CEO is Krista Scharfenberg. Sumi Agarwal is our acting editor-in-chief, and our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camerado, Lightning. Support for Reveals provided by the Reeve and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, the Democracy Fund, and the In As Much Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Edson, and remember, there is always more to the story.